The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Good afternoon and welcome to City Bible Forum. My name's Craig Josling. Really pleased that you're here today. We're doing a series at the moment called Questioning Faith. So we're having a careful and gentle look at other religions and comparing that to what Christianity says. So today we're comparing Buddhism and Christianity on the topic, the question of peace. Peace and peacefulness is something that people are seeking after in our busy, stressed city. Buddhism claims to have the way to peace, and so does Christianity. So we're going to have a look at that today. Our speaker is Ian Powell. Let me explain quickly the format of the meeting. Ian will speak for 20 minutes or so. Then it'll be your turn to ask questions or to make comments. And there's a number of ways that you can do that. Inside your program, there's a slip of paper. You'll see a pen on your chair. You can write your questions down on the slip of paper and at the appropriate time, hold it up and one of the ushers will collect it. You can text message your questions or comments to me, and you'll see inside your program there's a sheet of paper like that with my mobile number on it, or on the screen hopefully as well. The third way is that you can be brave and bold and you can stick up your hand at the appropriate time, and I've got a roving mic and you can just ask your question from the floor. It's a relaxed, friendly crowd, so please don't hesitate to ask questions and to make comments. I'm going to read one of the Bible passages that Ian will be referring to today. If you'd like to open up your program, it's from the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 11, verses 28 to 30. I'll read that for us, and then I'll hand over to Ian. "Come to me, all you that are weary and heavy burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light."
Good afternoon. It's good to be with you. And the next few weeks will be interesting, I think, and hopefully enjoyable. I've learned an enormous amount in the last few weeks preparing for today. Trying to fairly understand another point of view is much, much, much harder than some people realize. You probably realize it. But the whole debate that sometimes goes on even in church-based schools, why don't you just teach comparative religion? Frankly, most Australians haven't got the faintest clue what Christianity is about, even the feel of it. And to understand another worldview, whether it be Buddhism or Shintoism or Islam, is much harder than I think people realize. And I've been trying to be fair to Buddhism. Let me start with this question for you. In a fairly secure source within Buddhism, it says that when he was dying, when the Buddha was dying after 45 years or so of teaching, he said this: "I have taught two things." So he summarizes his 45 years of teaching. He said, "I have taught two things." What do you think those two things would be? If you had to guess, what do you think Buddha would summarize his teaching for 45 years as? This, it gives two things, this and this. I think, I think many people would put it somewhere, particularly with some of the great practitioners and sort of public faces of Buddhism, that it's a peace of mind, compassion. Happiness. Here's what the Buddha actually says. According to the Buddhist writings, "I have taught two things, suffering and its cessation." That is suffering and how to bring it to an end. And I think with due respect to the Buddha, that's a pretty good summary, I think, of what authentic Buddhism is about. We naturally think, I think, of Buddhism as a religion of peace, and it is in a sense. There's another religion well known that's often said by people who advertising it's a religion of peace. I think Buddhism has a far better claim to that. It's a deeply peaceful religion. It, like Christianity, has been abused at times. Japanese Buddhism had an enormous amount of soul searching to do after the Second World War, when it became captive to the imperial agenda, and looked back and saw that it had played a serious part in some of what they regretted had happened. There is shameful things happening in Buddhist monasteries, as there are in church orphanages and things like that. Every group has its problems. But as far as I can tell, with Buddhist writings and scriptures, peace is not a thing that it talks much about in its original form. Suffering and the end of suffering is the agenda in Buddhism. And that naturally has the sense of peace, I guess. Whereas explicitly the word peace is right up the front of Christian scriptures. So over 350 times, or just under 350 times, one of a number of words for peace turns up in the 66 books that make up the Bible. That's roughly five times in every book the word explicitly about peace is used and addressed. So there's no doubt that Christianity is overtly, and I think Buddhism indirectly, although if I'm wrong, I'd be happy to be wrong, and I'll put it up on our website if I've been. I don't intend to deliberately mislead. But I think for most of us, Buddhism seems to ooze, in the best possible sense, peace and love. It's seen rightly to be a gentle creed. Let me just remind you of the story of the prince. At the heart of Buddhism is the story, and the story of the Buddha, in a sense, is to be the story of us all. He is born a wealthy prince, safe, having a pleasure-filled life, protected by his dad. He's married. He's got one son called Rabula, which means fetter. Not entirely a positive name. Shackle or fetter is what it means. If you've got a son coming, you might like to think about that as a name. So it seems that the young prince already had a sense that there was something less than wonderful. He goes absent without leave from the palace. He sneaks out and he sees a sick man. He sees an old man. He sees a dead man. And he's confronted by the horrible reality that he'd apparently never seen in the palace of suffering. The ugly side of life. And he'd only ever seen the rich and the beautiful side of it. And he also saw a fourth thing, having seen sick, old and dead. He saw a holy man. What we would call, although it's a weird term to use of what was happening back 2,500 years ago, what we would call Hinduism. Hindu holy man, an ascetic, someone seeking to find the way to a better reincarnation. For 6 years, he said farewell to his wife and kid and the life of the palace, and he went off to seek enlightenment. For 6 years, he studied under the very best of Hindu, to use that phrase, Indian holy men, and was a strict ascetic. That is, he nearly starved himself to death. The description of his body is bones, 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 seeking desperately to find the answer to the problem of suffering and how to escape it. He had five sort of disciples who were impressed with his devotion and his insight. After 6 years, he got fed up with it. He realized that the way of pleasure doesn't do it, the way of asceticism and deprivation doesn't do it. He said, I'm going to sit under this tree until I get revelation. And he did that for 40 days, and then he saw a number of things, including his own life, lived over thousands of lives, rebirth after rebirth after rebirth. And he was enlightened. He was awake. He saw, he understood the root cause and the way to escape from the miseries of human life. He refound his five disciples who had deserted him. He wasn't going to speak, he said, but in the end they persuaded the enlightened one that he should speak, and so he did. So he taught for 45 years before he died. I'm going to leave out the quest for the historical Jesus and Buddha. We can come back to that in questions if you like, but I think it's fair to say, and this is not just my guy's better than your guy sort of childish nonsense, but there is no, to my knowledge, there is no reference to the life of the prince from North India who we know as the Buddha at all. At all. There's just no reference to him at all in any other historical document from the time, which is in marked contrast to Jesus, as you know, mentioned a number of times by Jewish contemporaries and by Roman historians from that period. There's about a 40, 50-year gap, some would say even less, between the life of Jesus and the first Gospels. There's about a 15-year gap between Jesus and the first explicit Christian writings that we've got. There's a 400-year gap between the life of the Buddha and anything being written down about him. It was taught orally. It doesn't mean it's unreliable. I'm not saying he didn't exist. I think it would be silly to say he didn't exist. But if it's silly to suggest the Buddha didn't exist, it's absolutely ridiculous to suggest Jesus didn't. But you'll meet people who play with that absurdity, not historians. So let's try and in a few seconds get to the heart, the essence, the quintessence, just to use a pretentious word, of Buddhism. And you can find it perhaps best, and these you can find on the net fairly easily, in the three great sermons of the Buddha, creatively named the first sermon, the second sermon, and the third one is called the Sermon of the Fires. It wasn't his third sermon. These are sermons, talks given to his the monks. He started off with monks, didn't think they should have nuns, and then his stepmother insisted that she wanted to become a nun. He said no. So she went back and found 300 other women. They shaved their heads like the blokes, and he said yes. All these are sermons, strong women, every culture. But in the three sermons, let's look at the first sermon, which and you'll be aware of some of this stuff, without a doubt, perhaps much more than I am. He lays out in the first sermon the Four Noble Truths. He starts with the Eightfold Path and then goes back to the Four Noble Truths. And the Four Noble Truths are all to do with suffering, the cause of suffering, how to end suffering. So the first noble truth is that all of life is suffering. Birth, life, loving, dying, everything is suffering. To live is to suffer. We're caught up in this dreadful cycle of samsara, which is birth, life, suffering, death, birth, life, suffering, death. It just goes on and 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 on. Interminably onward. And what Buddha saw in the moment of his enlightenment was the thousands and thousands and thousands of rebirths he had had before he had arrived at this point. And they'll be in and out of human life, down into hellish spirits, all sorts of things in the Buddhist cosmology. All of life is suffering. That's his basic insight. Everything is momentary and passing, and that's part of the pain. Secondly, the source of suffering, desire, craving, longing for things, for people, longing to escape things and people and events. That is the cause of suffering, craving, desire, longing, wanting. Now, this is more than when the Bible says, do not covet, the last of the Ten Commandments. I have joked with my friends who like to say they're Buddhists, and I said to them, I'm more of a Buddhist than you are. I said, I at least believe in not coveting. You spend your whole life craving for the next woman, the next house, the next holiday. You know, don't tell me you're a Buddhist. That's ridiculous. Your whole life is one explosion of craving and desiring. They're good little consumers. They're good Australians at that point. When the Bible says don't covet, it's not saying don't desire. It's saying don't desire what you have enough of already. The Bible doesn't think that human desire is in and of itself a bad thing at all. It sees it as part of the way God has made us. But it does see when you desire what you've got enough of already, that becomes greed, etc., and is very destructive. The Bible sees that. Buddhism sees that as the fundamental cause of all human suffering and misery. Three, the third noble truth is how to escape suffering by escaping craving, and that's the third law, that you escape suffering by escaping, you cease craving. It's easy. Do it. Cease longing for things. Cease wanting things. Cease hoping for things. Stop seeking relief from things. In fact, you don't reach enlightenment until you stop seeking to stop seeking. If you're desiring to stop desiring, you're not desiring. You're still desiring. It's a tough program. This is not for pansies. This thing, the Buddhist programs are very. It's a very strong program if you're going to reach enlightenment and nirvana eventually. You need to get detached from all affections, even your affection to yourself. Your affection for life, even your affection for non-life. This is a very full agenda here. Nirvana is the blowing out. And there's a lot of debate about what nirvana actually means, whether it means to cease to be, which is, certainly seems to be one consistent way to understand in terms of the word and in terms of Buddha's whole thing, that to live is to suffer. It might have come from a Pali word, nibbana, which is obviously closely related, which means to untie. But if you ask a learned Buddhist, what are you untying? There's no answer. Because there's no self. In fact, the Buddhist word for self means no self. But it doesn't mean there is no you, which is what I thought it meant when I first read it. It means that everything that you think is you is not you. So the you that you think of a second ago is not you. The you is now, it's gone. The you now is not what it was. You're just a result of past decisions and moments. So when I think of myself playing on the swing in Caffin Park at Rose Bay, that's not me when I was 10, whatever. And it's not going to be me tomorrow. You is not you. That whole sense that you have that you are a something that continues is everything is becoming. At one level, Buddhism says to be, but it says that the only way you can be is by becoming. If you think that you be, so you need to cease all craving for absolutely everything. Detachment is what you need. It's what you long for to be happy. This is a deep world to get into, I think, and for most people, Buddhism is rightly a bit confusing in its serious sense. The fourth noble truth, the third one is stop craving. The second one is the examination of why we suffer, which is craving. The first one is life is suffering. The fourth noble truth is the Eightfold Path that the Buddha gives. It's very practical. The Eightfold Path, you've got it there in the notes, is right understanding, which means meditate upon the Four Noble Truths. Right aim, that all your directions should be about escaping this world of samsara, constant round and round. Right speech, right actions, right livelihood. No lying, no slander, no rudeness, no stealing, no killing, no sex outside of marriage, no intoxicants. And the number of conversations I've had with my friends and peers over a glass of wine as they told me how wonderful Buddhism was, I didn't realise how absurd that was. Because Buddhism has the same view of alcohol as Islam does. It's not the view that Christianity has, which you can enjoy the good gift of wine, Jesus' first miracle in John's Gospel, but drunkenness is sin. No intoxicants of any form are part of the right living. Right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. The right concentration takes you into all the meditation that we think of instinctively when we think of Buddhism. The two basic forms are in-out, where you just breathe in and out and become conscious of the breathing, not just as a holistic thing, but every part of the breathing. Every second of it, because you're trying to realize that everything is flux. Everything in, out, in, out. And this will calm you, as my grandmother and mother taught me and taught my brothers and sisters when they were angry with me and wanted to hit me, they'd take a deep breath. This is an old wisdom that's found almost everywhere, that to slow down with your breathing is a great help to calm down. And then intense mindfulness, and the attempt is to stop the monkeys in the head, to shut them up. This is hard work. All is flux, all is change. Yourself is non-self. Emptiness is what you seek. That is, if you read Buddhist writings, and I read this phrase, and I kept it, what on earth does that mean? Inside all of us is the Buddha nature, they say, particularly Zen Buddhism, which means is the emptiness. Right? It's the emptiness that accepts whatever is there. Not with a resigned, crap, I don't like it, but I've got to accept it, but that accepts it happily. Whatever it is, whatever you're in front of, you accept it. And this will lead you out of the world of suffering. There are three basic types of Buddhism. The two most famous ones are Theravada, which is dominant in places like Sri Lanka, Burma, Laos, Cambodia, Vietnam, and Mayana. I'm sorry, I probably butchered those words. I'm as bad with Indian words as I am with French words. Mahayana, I think, is the second one, which has got more people who would describe themselves. It's called the Great Vehicle or Way of Salvation. Theravada has a much smaller canon of scripture, much smaller. The Mahayana one is still growing. Theravada is sort of seen by Western scholars many times. It's spoken of as classical Buddhism, whereas Mahayana is seen to be more popularist. It's more infected with other cultural additions over time. Theravada Buddhism is clear that you can't pray to anybody. There's no help except in yourself. Where Mahayana Buddhism is much happy with the idea of all sorts of people you can pray to, including the Buddha himself. And the spirit of the cosmic Buddha is at work in all sorts of people and times and places. Both of them deeply tied to the four and the eight. There's another one which is smaller and it's part of the Mahayana, which is famous really through Tibetan Buddhism in our culture, which is probably the best known of all the Buddhisms in our culture. And that's what's called Tantric Buddhism. It's rich in costumes, geometric designs and patterns, mantras, invocations, things like that. That's the one that's good the media like that because it's easy to film, right? Because it's dramatic and colourful. The fourth, and you heard it here first, the fourth sort of Buddhism is Charanaya Buddhism, okay? Sorry about that. It's what you often meet, and please don't, I've met Anglo-Celtic people, deeply, seriously Buddhist, you know, who are really serious. But most of what we meet in Australia is Chardonnay Buddhism. It's Chardonnay Buddhism. It's the wealthy person who lived their whole life to make money and more money and more money and do you out of business and buy and travel and, you know, trade up with relationships, etc., etc., and then has a Buddha statue in their garden. Right? And we'll say to you at the dinner party, well, I'm a little different. I'm into Buddhism. And I always want to finish a sentence for them. Now, I think behind that, and I probably shouldn't be such a rat and send it up, but behind it, I think, is a longing for more, but an unwillingness to look at the Jesus question. And I remember seeing this so clearly illustrated. This quite lovely lady was on an ABC religious program. There was the ABC journalist, there was her, and there was a Sri Lankan Buddhist monk. And Sri Lankan Buddhism is Theravada Buddhism at its purest and most austere, in a sense. Many would say it's the purest that you're going to run into, the closest to the Buddha himself. And there's this discussion, and basically it had two classic parts. The woman was explaining why she'd left her Catholicism, and which I imagine she probably didn't ever really get into, but she was Catholic by family, I think. She said, well, you know, the great thing about Buddhism is, unlike Christianity, it's got no dogma. There's not all these things that you have to believe. There's no dogma. And the Sri Lankan Buddhist monk was just sitting there and he went, just obviously surprised at what he'd heard. And he said, what do you think the Dharma is? The Dharma is one of the three great parts of Buddhism. The Dharma is the teaching. It's the dogma. There's lots of things that... The Four Noble Truths, for example. You know, so the Sri Lankan Buddhist just looked shocked at this, but this woman's liberation, finding a spirituality with nothing, no dogma. And they said, well, that might be the case, but there's no Ten Commandments, there's no guilt, there's no laws. And again, the Buddhist monk looked gently surprised and said, there are thousands of commands from the Buddha. And there are thousands of commands if you're a serious Buddhist. And really, I mean, you know, Judaism and Christianity are just, it's a flea weight in terms of laws and commandments. But there's this Western thing that we can sort of just make it up to be whatever we like, which is disrespectful, I take it, of the Buddha himself. Well, let me try, and just by way of conclusion, then we may be more helped in the question time itself. On the question of peace in Buddhism and Christianity, I was at an airport this morning coming down from Brisbane, and there was a lady who'd been messed around with flights. She'd travelled from LA, and it was a nightmare story. And she asked me what I was doing, and I said, I'm going to give us talk about Jesus and Buddha and peace of mind, the quest for peace. She said, well, I haven't got much peace. And she was quite in good spirits, but she knew she was cranky and with good reason, I think. Well, what would a Buddhist say to someone seeking peace of mind? Someone who's living with anxiety and fretfulness and a mind that never shuts up and they can't rest even when they're sleeping. At a popular level, and I checked this up particularly with the Dalai Lama, he only represents, it's worth noticing with the Dalai, he's not like the Pope, who is the leader of about a billion people, technically. The Dalai Lama is not even the leader of Tibetan Buddhism. He's the leader of one of five strands of Tibetan Buddhism. And I'm not saying this to put the guy down. It's just that people seem to think that he's kind of... many Buddhists find it a little offensive the way that he's spoken of as he is like the Pope. He's not at all like the Pope. Good and great man as he is in many ways. This is the advice. Suffering, needing peace of mind. Note first the great first noble truth. Of course you're suffering. Life is suffering. Get over it. Right? Stop panicking because you're suffering. And that's actually kind of wisdom from all over the place. Stop panicking at the fact you're suffering and realise that life is suffering. My grandmother knew that. My mother knew that. W. Scott Peck knows that. We've read that quote from W. Scott Peck, the American non-Christian psychiatrist, many times from this platform here. Life is difficult. This is a great truth. He would say that, which helps you accept what's happening. And then you are offered techniques, breathing techniques, meditative techniques. Don't sweat the small stuff. Everything is small stuff. All sorts of advice you'll be given. And these will work, frankly. If you're stressed and hyped and you follow some of the techniques or technologies that popular Buddhism, it will give you some, it will lower stress factors. They're not idiots. They've been working on this stuff for thousands of years, and it works, and so it should. What about if you talk to a popular mainline Christian about peace of mind? We're not going to be as helpful in the short term. We're not going to offer you prayer as a technique to relieve worry. That's not what prayer is about. We are going to do something completely different. We're going to point you to a person. We're going to invite you into a relationship with a person who you may or may not know well, you might not know them at all. The person who is called in his book the Prince of Peace, and for good reason. One of his earliest followers in one of his writings said, "He is our peace, Jesus." The Jesus who, unlike the Buddha, calls you not to the Eightfold Path, but Jesus calls you to himself. And it's in the relationship with him, in all his power and greatness and love and wisdom, it's in a relationship with Jesus that you will find peace. Perfect peace, the Bible speaks about. The peace that passes all understanding. These are all phrases out of the words of God. So you can see there in Matthew, Jesus called, "Come to me." Not come to my way of teaching, but come to me. John 16. "I've told you these things so that in me you may have peace." Peace is not found in you. It's not a journey inward, which Buddhism will lead you to. Find your peace in this other person. "You will have suffering in the world. Be courageous. I've conquered the world." What Jesus leads us to is a peace that is there, not because we've learned to zone out and to empty our minds of worries, but that we fill our minds with the truth of who he is, in both his greatness and his power and his closeness. Serious Buddhism will take you... I don't like that book, Don't Sweat the Small Stuff, Everything's Small Stuff. I think I like the first part, but the second part I find irritating. As I understand true Buddhism, it's smaller than small. Right? All the things that you worry about are not worth worrying about. And if you only had some light, some enlightenment, you would be detached, like all those lovely statues we see of the Buddha, with this detached peacefulness, sitting on his own in the lotus position, rising above in the midst of, in this personal peace, which comes from detachment rather than involvement, right, which is what God in Jesus does. Now, I'll shut up there so we've got some time for questions.
Great. Well, as I said before, you can ask in questions three ways. You can write it down on the slip of paper in your program. Just hold it up. Mark or Caro will collect those, pass them on to Ian. I've got a few text messages here. You can keep texting questions or comments. Or if you'd like, you can just stick up your hand and ask a question. So I might start with that method first. Anyone like to just ask a question from the floor?
Hi, Ian. Could you explain a bit further how coming to Jesus will give us peace?
Yes, I'll try. One of the things that Christians do, all religions chant. Christianity is famously the singing religion. It irritates people sometimes that we sing. And one of the great songs we sing, it goes like this: "The King of love my shepherd is, whose goodness faileth never. I nothing lack if I am his, and he is mine forever." That's taking a famous part of the Bible, Psalm 23, and saying it's that relationship with someone who is loving, powerful. As he says there, "I've conquered the world," as he shows by beating death itself. It's knowing that that one is with me, overseeing what is happening. Now, at one level, it leads you sometimes to rage and anger because you say to God, "All right! I get you're powerful. What is going on? Why is this happening?" So but it's an interaction with God, with a person. And it's not suggesting life will be easy and smooth, etc. But it's saying in the midst of, well, as that psalm says, "When I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I'll fear no evil, for you are with me." It's that relationship. It's the better we know Jesus, the more we will learn to enjoy. Like if you've ever done abseiling, first time you do it very tentatively. And then you get to the point, this works. The rope works. The metal works. My friend works. And you enjoy it more. You were as safe the first time as you were the last time. But you get to enjoy the safety. But I'd still be careful who I do it with. Yeah. So it's to do with not knowing yourself, but knowing him. Yeah. Any other questions from the floor?
Questions from the floor?
Right. You got any on that phone of yours?
I do. How does Buddhism understand things like memory if there's no self?
Don't know.
Okay.
I'd be guessing. I could guess, but I don't know.
What difference, if any, is there between peace as a state of social and diplomatic harmony and simply the absence of suffering?
Yes, the word peace and its opposite, which in Buddhism I think is probably suffering, in Christianity would be a number of things, enmity. Peace works at a personal level. We can talk about personal peace, or we can talk about world peace, peace in families, peace in the workplace. Christianity and Buddhism are often referred to as sources of possible wisdom about this. Islam, that's next week. Buddhism's overwhelming concern, up until really the last few years, where there's a new movement about called engaged Buddhism, has been about you. Well, the not you that looks like you, seeking to avoid, to leave the world of suffering. So it has been about withdrawal, because the world is a world of illusion and chaos and mistakes. So it's basically, when I've read some stuff in the last weeks about Buddhists talking about peace, it's really about you being a person of peace and coming in. They would tend not to think that you should. They would, in classical Buddhism, you don't have a goal and an agenda you go for. It's just being. Although the being is not being, it's becoming. So it's one of the reasons why. So Christians and Jews use the word peace to mean wholeness and wellness. It's not just the absence of war. But it's the absence of war. And so peace with God is a key thing, forgiveness and pardon. But the last thing that's worth noting is this, and again, this is going to sound as if I'm being rude. Buddhism has no history of loving intervention. It has nothing like World Vision, the Red Cross, all these things that Christians set up. It has no history of setting up hospitals or schools except for monks. Now, they have of late done it, which I think is the thing they've learnt from watching other faiths at work. Whereas Christianity has been, from the very beginning, it's been a hospital medicine religion. It's what we've done from the first hundreds of years, because Jesus does. You go out, you don't just not respond badly to violence. At this point, the ethics of the Buddha and the ethics of Jesus Christ are not dissimilar. That is, you never meet fire with fire, which some religions think you can. But Christianity says more. It says don't just not meet hate with hate, but it says meet hate with positive love. Love your enemies. Do good. I've seen many parallels where people put the words, and the teaching of the Buddha is very impressive. But the teaching of Jesus is not just don't return hate for hate, but return love for hate. So Christians have got this history of intervention, changing things, seeking to bring well-being at every level that we can.
Does Buddhism have a concept of karma? And if so, who controls karma?
Right, the two questions. Does Buddhism have a concept of karma? Yes. It's not the same as Hinduism, as their rebirth doctrine is not the same as reincarnation. I'd be lying to you if I said I've got to the bottom of the difference. Because you get karma in a negative sense, even by willing to do a good action. Any willed action is running against the universe and will create sparks. So even to will actively and to do something good, in some of the pure teachings of Buddhism, is itself building up bad karma. Because what you must do is stop all willful action and just, I'm not sure what you do, but yes, karma, and that will reshape your rebirth, but not in the same scale way that Hinduism tends to speak of. But karma is a big part of Buddhist thinking, and it will control your rebirth, of which any of us here, as I understand, none of us here, in fact, the Dalai Lama doesn't think he's going to Nirvana when he dies. In fact, that's what led a lady who I've been learning a lot from over the last few years, who is a very serious student of Buddhism, has become a Christian but has an enormous respect for the Buddha and what he was trying to do. One of the things that led her out, as I understand it, was she went on a retreat with the Dalai Lama, and when he said he doesn't think he's going to, she thought, well, maybe this whole system doesn't work all that well. You know, if someone who's been a monk since he was five and is a deeply impressive man in all sorts of ways, but karma will, it's there, but and no one knows who controls karma. Is that it?
Yep, that's it in terms of the text questions. Any more questions from the floor? This is your last chance.
Okay.
To quiz the guru out the front.
No, the guru.
Here we go.
Yeah, that's right.
Ian, Jesus also said, I didn't come to bring peace but a sword.
He did.
How do we reconcile that with John 16 there?
It's this famous statement by Jesus that gets used and misused by all sorts of people, where Jesus says, do not think I came to bring peace, but I come to bring a sword, and then explains it. To set a mother against her daughter, a son against his mother-in-law, all that sort of stuff. And what he's talking at there is that don't think that my coming is going to bring in universal peace. In fact, if you give your allegiance to me, you may find that your own family shuns you. So I met a man when I was in Uganda who became a Christian in Yemen. Difficult place to become a Christian. Bibles are illegal. He went to a church to get a Bible, but he was from a well-known family in Yemen, a famous political family, and they wouldn't give him one because they feared, there's only two or three churches in Yemen apparently, left over from the British Empire. But he, all the websites to read the Bible in Arabic have all been locked down by the government. He was in the end in trouble when he tried to smuggle a Bible in to read it. When he became a Christian, he had to flee because he would be executed by his family or his government. That's what Jesus is talking about. So he's not saying, you know, I bring the sword, as some religions happily will use the sword, but he's saying my coming will actually cause problems sometimes for you. I've seen that in my own family at times, that devotion to Jesus both brings peace because people are more peaceful, but also brings tension because there is in the heart of humans, according to the Bible, a resentment against God. And if someone stands, that's what I think he's saying. He's not saying you can use a sword, but there will be relational difficulties, which I'm sure you've seen.
Thanks very much. And thanks for your questions. It was a good forum today. Just a few things before we head back to wherever we're going this afternoon. Next Tuesday, we're putting on a forum welcome lunch, and that's for people who have come along to the forum in the last year or so. And the benefits for you coming are that you receive a free lunch. It's going to be held just across the way in St Andrew's House in a nice comfortable boardroom. You get a chance to meet Ian Powell a bit more personally, hear a bit about Ian's background and his spiritual journey, as well as to get to meet some other people who work around this area. So if you're reasonably new to City Bible Forum and you haven't been to one of these welcome lunches before, please register, and all the details are on that A5 sheet. We'd love to see you there. I'll be there myself. Secondly, Ian mentioned that Christianity claims that peace can be found in a person rather than a philosophy or a teaching, and that person is Jesus. If you'd like to check out more about Jesus, on the back table we've got some Gospels about Jesus' life, teaching, and you're free to take one of those. There's no cost for that. Ian also has a little handout, a timeline of some key Buddhist dates that you can take if you'd like. And finally, on the back table, we have the Easter reading guide. And it's basically reading through the Easter story. And in there, there's interviews with city workers about how they responded to the various parts of the Easter story. $2, great thing to read or to give away around this time of year. Next week, we're looking at the Islam and the question of paradise. I hope you can join us then. Have a great afternoon.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.